Welcome to season 19 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Welcome back. The last episode of season 19 is here, and it's one of my favorite conversations of the season with my friend Sam Walker. And Sam Walker is the author of a book called The Captain Class, which I listened to on Audible and just loved it. If you're a sports fan at all, if you've ever been interested why the best teams in sports exist, this book is for you. I mean, I just ate it up, and I know you will too. And my conversation with Sam doesn't just revolve around sports, though. I mean, there's so many applicable lessons that the greatest captains of the greatest teams of all times exhibited. And so, you know, as you listen to this, I know you're not probably a coach of a sports team, so I want you to really think about how this stuff applies in your journey, in with your team, in your workplace, because there's so many applicable lessons. So without further ado, here is my super interesting conversation with my friend Sam Walker, the author of The Captain Class. Just a quick word from our sponsor. Next week, I'm going to be in San Francisco, February 26th and 27th, at the Work Rebooted Conference. That's Work Rebooted on February 26th and 27th. If you're going to be in San Francisco, you can use the code FOLLOWMYLEAD30. FOLLOWMYLEAD30 at registration to receive 30% off of the registration code. I'd love to meet you if you're going to be there. Again, San Francisco, February 26th and 27th, the Work Rebooted Conference. Now on to the show. Well, Sam, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
The big question is, why are we so obsessed in this intersection between sports and business?
Man, it's such a good question. You know, it's funny. I was working on a column today for the journal, and it's about seafaring and this disaster at sea. And as I was going through, I was like, why is this so fun? Why is it so fun to write this column? And I realized because, man, nautical terminology is great. You know, it's just, there's a word for everything, and it's a colorful word. It's kind of like golf, you know, it has a lot of lingo that's really cool. And I think sports in some ways, you know, is kind of the language. There's such a rich language of describing things and explaining events. And I think that's part of it, really. I mean, I think people that are good at business and who are competitive are also inclined to sports, obviously, and there's a lot of crossover. But, you know, it's funny. I think we all need a language for describing competition and pressure and, you know, beating an opponent and coming up with a strategy, all the things that are so important in business. And, you know, there's just the lingo of business is so, I mean, it's just like alphabet soup. I mean, you know, every industry is different and everything. It's sort of the one common language that everyone can use. So I think that feeds into it as well. But it's definitely there. It's funny. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about it because my book, you know, the great shock of my book. I mean, you said before we started, you know, that when you write a book, you never know what's going to happen. And in my case, that was completely true because I wrote a sports book, you know, and we kind of marketed it as a sports book, and everything around the rollout was kind of heavily sports based. But right away, it just became very clear that the people that were really, you know, buying it and really engaging were business people. And, you know, all the reviews were in the business section. And, you know, it was very clear I'd written a business book, you know, even though I didn't mean to. I thought it would have business applications, but I didn't know it would basically just be put on that shelf.
Well, the book, The Captain Classes, that you're referring to, it was so interesting because you examined teams from all over the world. And I think the first question that anyone that hasn't read it or doesn't know much about it is, how did you sort through all of the sports teams to come up with tier one or the best 16 teams of all time?
I mean, I just had to basically define excellence. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to look at teams that had sustained excellence, not one-year wonders. You know, so I set this minimum of 4 years of dominance, you know, based on you know, the odds of chance, because there's no way a team can get lucky for 4 years. I mean, that's a culture, right? And then I decided, look, I mean, I had to make some brutal cuts because, you know, if you're going to be the greatest team of all time, you know, there's a certain things that have to apply. And the first is that you competed at the absolute highest level of your sport. So all American college teams, to my great disappointment, had to fall out because it's not the highest level of the sport. And after that, you know, there were so many teams that had been great, but they hadn't played the other great teams of the era. And a lot of teams in the early part of the 20th century just, you know, never played that rival from another country. And so you didn't really know if they were the best. So that weeded a lot of them out. But really the thing that ultimately knocked it down was, you know, I just decided, look, if you're going to say you're the greatest team of all time, or one of them, you better be the greatest team in the history of your own sport. Right. So they had to have done something unique, you know, whether it was a number of titles won or just the longevity of their winning, you know, something that no team had ever done before in that sport. So that really narrowed it down. And, you know, I got to 16 for the hardcover, and then the Patriots, you know, made it to the Super Bowl, and that put them ahead of the 49ers dynasty. And so I put them in as well. So there were 17 in the end. But look, I mean, you know, in the book, I have tier two, that's tier one, and tier two were the 120 odd other teams that, you know, were just as good. They just were kind of one little asterisk away from being in the top rank.
So when you started, Sam, once you got down to these now 17 tier one teams and 120 something tier two teams, did you know at the beginning how important the captain would be?
No, I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I thought it might be something that I hadn't anticipated, just because, you know, I got this idea from being around a lot of great teams, you know, being a sports writer, and I felt like it might be something intangible because, you know, I'd seen teams like the Boston Red Sox in 2004, you know, a team that was left for dead in July, and all of a sudden something just clicked, and it was different. I mean, there was an intangible feeling about the team and everything, and I felt like maybe it would be something that wasn't so obvious. But, you know, I didn't think this is where it would end up. You know, I cheated a little. You know, as soon as I found a team that was clearly in the top tier, I would start looking at it. And pretty early on, I'd say, I started to see this pattern. And it started with, I think, the Boston Celtics and Bill Russell. And, you know, that incredible winning streak of 11 titles in 13 seasons, which began as soon as he arrived and ended the minute he left, you know, and I thought, wow, that's kind of uncanny. And then I found this, the New Zealand All Blacks from 86 to 90, you know, another team that made it clearly belong in the top tier. And it was the same thing, you know. It started when this guy Buck Shelford showed up, but then became captain. And the minute they got rid of him, 2 weeks later, they lost their first match in 3 years. And, you know, I saw it. I thought, that's really weird. And so I put those aside. And, you know, after a while, I started looking for it and seeing it over and over. But, you know, I didn't know. I didn't really believe that there could be that strong a correlation. So, you know, I kept going. I mean, I looked at talent, you know, and I realized that, you know, abundant talent wasn't necessarily the thing, because some teams had it, some teams didn't. And then the same applied to tactics, you know, brilliant and not always brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the same thing applied to coaching. You know, coaching blew me away. I mean, I thought that's where we might end up. And, you know, I just realized right away that most of these coaches were, you know, not considered great or even had losing records or had been fired from their last job before they took over. And some of these teams have changed coaches and kept winning. So it's not that coaches weren't important. It's just that, you know, that wasn't the thing. And in the end, it just got to be uncanny. I mean, it was uncanny. You know, I could find some team I had not considered. Someone's like, what about this field hockey team from, you know, from Australia? And, you know, I would look into it, and sure enough, I would find the same thing. This captain who was there at the beginning and at the end, you know, and, you know, the more I started looking at these people and what they were like, I realized that there was a pattern emerging that was real. And I wasn't making it up, or it wasn't confirmation bias. It wasn't, you know,
yeah.
I'd done so much work that it was like, clearly there was something happening there.
Well, let's talk about these captains. Okay. Because I think most people listening are probably like, well, I'm not that kind of person. I couldn't be the captain of a team.
Right.
But what's interesting was they were rarely the best player, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, a few of them were. I mean, I don't think that talent precludes great leadership. But, you know, what I realized quickly was that it must be really difficult to be a great captain. Because, you know, I really picked up on this when I looked at Brazil and the great Brazilian soccer team, you know, the one back-to-back World Cups in 58 and 62. And I sought out Pelé because I wanted to talk to him about it. And I was shocked. I didn't know at that point that he'd never been the captain. You know, and he said something so interesting. He said, I never wanted to be the captain. No one ever thought I should be the captain because, you know, what Brazil realized was that, you know, when you're a superstar, there's so much pressure on you to just do your job and to be a superstar. And, you know, he had the additional pressure of being the most famous, one of probably the most famous person in the world. So
I love that quote, you know, about Jesus. That was fantastic.
Yeah, right? I mean, he was probably, if you took a poll, you know. But anyway, I realized then that, you know, that talent, it doesn't preclude you from being a great leader. It's just most superstar athletes don't have time. They don't have the time to do the emotional labor behind the scenes that a captain needs to do. And so, yeah, that was one thing. I mean, so the stardom thing was really surprising. And the other thing was, it wasn't just that they weren't stars. A lot of them were these role players, and they were water carriers. They were people who, you know, were central defenders. They did really unglamorous work. You know, they did all the things on the field that needed to be done, you know, that they would never get credit for. And you would never notice them in the highlight reels, and they never did anything spectacular. In fact, some of them never scored. You know, they just were constantly looking to help teammates. And it also got weird because, you know, they hated attention. You know, they didn't like the spotlight. Most of them were very wary of being singled out and didn't care about individual accolades at all. You know, Bill Russell like turned down the Hall of Fame. He said he didn't want to be in it because, you know, it's not a team honor. And you know, they did weird things like that. So that was part of it. But then the real thing that started to surprise me was, you know, I thought of leadership. I always thought a great captain was kind of a diplomat, like someone who would always work really hard to diffuse conflict inside a team. And, you know, would be someone who would be the least likely person to push back. But the opposite was true. I mean, they were really difficult to manage. And, you know, they would get their back up by anything they thought was hurting the team's ability to win, even if it was something tiny. And, you know, they pushed the rules. I mean, they played right up to the edge of the rules to the point where people would, you know, really shame them for dirty play. And mm-hmm. you know, none of this stuff really made sense to me. I had to spend a lot of time looking into it and figuring out what was really happening, and then looking at a lot of, you know, scientific research, behavioral research that has explored those topics to really understand what was going on. And what I found in the end was that there were 7 traits that they had in common, and they had other traits in common too, but you know, these were the 7 things that in the end I realized actually made the team better in some way. You know, I mean, that was the big test for me. You can take a bunch of people and say, who are good at something, and say, hey, they have this in common, so that must be why they're great, right? Correlation is causation, right? But it's not. And I realized that I had to find the traits that I could show actually made the team better and why. And there were only 7 of those. And those are the 7 traits that I focus on in the book.
Well, the one that really jumps out at me of all of them was just this idea that a low-key, practical, and democratic communication style. I mean, everybody thinks that the best leaders are the ones that can get up there and give the big speech and can communicate in a way that just is, they're so naturally gifted and those kinds of things. And while there are leaders that can communicate in brilliant ways, that's the one that kind of stood out to me the most. And I couldn't help but, you know, use the example of Tim Duncan in the book, you know, the Hall of Fame forward for the San Antonio Spurs. But just touch on a little bit, maybe specifically about communication and why communication is so important in the way these people lead. And then secondarily, you know, why is it so important for just leaders today in general?
Absolutely. I think this was one of the biggest surprises, if not the biggest surprise to me. Partly because of what you mentioned, this Hollywood, idea. I mean, any Hollywood movie, if you watch it, you know, before some big competition, I don't care if it's basketball, football, poetry, I mean, you know, anything, someone gives a speech and it's to fire up the troops, this idea that you motivate people through words and that that's part of leadership. And I bought into that. I mean, you know, I was a huge speech guy, you know, like if I had to give a speech at a wedding or something, I practice it. You know what I mean? I really believed in that whole thing. And, you know, I was just completely astounded. And it wasn't just that they didn't like to give speeches. I mean, none of them, not one of these captains liked giving speeches. I mean, some of them would do it, you know, but some of them never did. Carlos Puyol, who's the captain of the great Barcelona team, you know, in the 2000s, the greatest club soccer team of all time, he told me he never once addressed the entire team. Not once. Never in his entire career. He said I didn't like to do it. He wasn't any good at it. He thought it was corny, you know, and never did it. And I saw that and it just blew me away. So, you know, that's when I started looking into it. Well, okay, how do they lead? How do they motivate people? And, you know, what I realized was, you know, I kept hearing teammates and people say, well, you know, I would describe them as quiet, and they would sort of look at me funny, like, but we're quiet. You know, they were quiet publicly, but they're like, inside the team, these leaders were often very vocal, you know, and they were vocal in a very specific way, though, in that, you know, they did so many little things and so many acts of service for the team that everyone kind of understood that they had no ego and that they weren't in it for themselves. And this gave them this kind of credibility, you know, with their teammates. And because their teammates knew where they were coming from, they would listen very intently and their message would get through. But the way they communicated was fascinating. I mean, this is Tim Duncan to a T. I mean, he says nothing in public. He's the most boring interview of all time. But, you know, behind the scenes, eyes are always moving. He's looking for that teammate that needs some encouragement or some criticism or, you know, just congratulations or something. And, you know, he'll pull them aside. It's never the whole team or in front of people. And he'll have a very intense conversation. It's a conversation. I mean, he listens as much as he talks. And he uses his facial expressions. He's only got like two of them. I mean, you know what he's thinking, right? And he touches people and he gets – these are very intense – interactions, and that's how he talks to people, and he does it constantly. I mean, he's constantly doing it. I mean, he's always looking for that opportunity. It's tiring, exhausting work, but that's how they do it. That's how they all did it. And, you know, they were incredibly effective, you know, communicators, even though they were not eloquent. You know, I mean, Tim Duncan was not charismatic at all. And, you know, my favorite example is Yogi Berra, you know, who oversaw the greatest baseball team of all time, 5 straight World Series titles. And, you know, the idea of Yogi Berra giving a big speech is hilarious, right? I mean, guy was, he tripped over his words famously. So being articulate wasn't the thing. It was just work. It was just the volume of communication. You know, and there's a study that I found, which was one of the great kind of breakthrough moments that MIT had done. And it was so fascinating. So they have these digital recorders that people wear, and these things pick up everything. I mean, whether it's voice, you know, facial expression, intensity, how long everyone talks, it picks up everything. And they found that the great teams that performed the best all had the same data signature, and that there was one person who would circulate widely. Everyone felt comfortable approaching them. They felt comfortable approaching everyone, and they would have those intense one-on-one conversations that were very two-sided. And that kind of confirmed exactly this Tim Duncan model. And I think that's really one of the great, you know, things that this research revealed, which is like, you know, you don't have to have a silver tongue. You know, you just need to do a lot of work and spend a lot of time intensely talking to people one-on-one.
Well, I think what I'm thinking about, which means maybe our audience is thinking about it too. Well, I'm, you know, these are like the 16, you know, great captains and the sports teams of all time, and communication is a big part of it. And it's not always giving big speeches. I mean, can anybody go learn from these traits, or are these people born with these innate things?
It's a great question. I mean, the thing that I think is, I have two things to say. I spent a lot of time thinking about this because, you know, it's that question, are great leaders made or born? And, you know, I think there are two parts to it. And the first part is, you know, I studied exceptional people, you know, and they already had an exceptional level of talent because they were in professional sports. And I do think that there, you know, are just certain people who have that potential, you know, to be this kind of great leader. And I think there are a lot more people than we realize, you know, that have it. And I think there are also a lot of people we think have it who don't. But, you know, it's one thing to have the potential, and that's a pretty big pool. It's not everyone. But once you have that potential, then the other thing you need is the motivation. Mm-hmm. You know, because that's what's missing is, like, not everyone is motivated to do it, even if they have the right instincts and the right personality. You know, they're not motivated to do it. But the third piece is development. And, you know, none of these captains showed up on day one and were the leaders of the team. I mean, they all had time to sort of apprentice. You know, some had very little time, but some of them had, you know, a year or two. You know, and they had some good role models. So I think development is, that's where coaches come in. That's where, you know, culture comes in. And I think that's a big part of it. So that's really the formula. I mean, I think these people, my sense is, and the one thing that I didn't get into in the book, because it was hard to pin down, is there's a certain level of emotional intelligence. And I don't like that term because I'm not sure exactly what it's supposed to mean. But in the context I'm using it, like, I mean that Tim Duncan was really kind of a unique guy. I mean, he was from, you know, the Caribbean, you know, and he went to, you know, school in North Carolina. He was the kind of person who could talk to anyone. I mean, he could be comfortable with, you know, very, you know, kind of well-educated, upper-class kind of people. But he could also talk to anyone, you know, no matter what their background was. And I think they had this understanding of people and their motives, and they would be able to figure people out and understand how to reach them and approach them. And, you know, that's something that we still haven't figured out how to measure, but I think that's a huge part of it. I think that ability to really crack anyone and figure anyone's motivations out. A lot of these captains, you know, had traumatic things happen to them, you know, when they were young, and they had setbacks and failures and things they had to overcome. And I think that helps. I think when you go through something really emotionally difficult, you get sort of awareness of other people, and you become more sensitive to other people's emotions and thoughts. And I think that helps. So I'm not sure that's the reason, but,
well, that's interesting. Fact. Yeah. I mean, you know, you quote the famous Vince Lombardi, leaders are made, not born. And there are these seemingly innate qualities, right? And I think the part that's probably most interesting of all is you wrote, something that I really highlighted was, leadership is a selfless burden. And you talk about that motivation that, you know, if it's, you know, if that potential is one thing, and then having the motivation to go do it, you know, and if leadership is a selfless burden and someone is not innately or doesn't care about thinking about anybody themselves, their motivation to go be a great leader or a great captain is just not going to happen.
Right.
And so that a whole idea that, yes, even those people with innate God-given potential when it comes to leadership, they still have to have the motivation. And anyone, whether you have that God-given potential or not, now I'm talking to our audience, but it's like you still got to have that motivation to go be selfless in nature. And I think that was so unique in the story. And I do want you to touch on this story of Michael Jordan and Bill Cartwright, because, you know, everybody knows Michael Jordan's the greatest, the GOAT, right? The greatest basketball player of all time. But when it came down to it, and you really look at when they started to get successful as a team, when this guy named Bill Cartwright came along. So tell us that story about the Bulls. And because I think it's a little bit more of a modern example that people could really all gravitate to knowing who Michael Jordan is.
Yeah, no, and I get a lot of tomatoes from Amy in Chicago, you know, for this. But, you know, I could not believe it. I mean, the Bulls, to me, I knew I had to look at them. They didn't make my top tier. They were in the second tier, but, you know, because they didn't win as many titles as Bill Russell. But they were an amazing team, and I had to figure them out. So I actually wrote a half chapter about them in the book. And I did not understand this because Michael Jordan did not fit my profile. You know, I mean, I knew going in that he didn't fit, and he was close. He had a lot of great leadership qualities, but he didn't have that that emotional control that all the other captains had. I mean, you know, it wasn't that he was out of control in the court; it's that he just never turned off, right? I mean, he would leave a game and go gamble or play ping pong. I mean, play golf, and he was always on and always competing. He just couldn't kind of rest and recover, you know? And I think really the reason he walked away was just burnout. I just think he couldn't sustain, you know, that level of intensity. But the other thing that was different about Jordan was that he had a really sharp tongue, and he would belittle his teammates in very personal ways. And none of these captains did that. They would criticize people only in the context of making the team better. They would never make it personal. They would go out of their way to make sure that their criticism wasn't taken personally. And, you know, that wasn't him, and I didn't understand it. So I looked at the team, and, you know, I'd forgotten, because we all forgot, but, you know, the first six seasons when he was in Chicago, they didn't win. And the knock on him was he's going to be the greatest player in the history of the NBA, never won a title. That was his rap. And, you know, I started going back and looking at the season when they broke through, and it was 1990, and or 1990, right? And I found this little thing in the Chicago Tribune that I it was a little tiny, you know, 24 word, you know, piece, and it said that Phil Jackson had named Bill Cartwright as the co-captain of the Bulls, and this was early in the season. They had started off very badly, but they were kind of maybe 500 at the beginning of the season. It didn't look good for them. And then from that day on, literally that day, I need to make a chart of this. They just couldn't be beat. And they went on to win, 71 games. They won their first title. And, you know, that was the moment. It's clear as a day when they became, you know, a championship caliber team. And, you know, the thing that was so surprising about this is that Jordan hated Cartwright. I mean, they had traded Charles Oakley, who was Jordan's favorite guy on the team, for Cartwright. And
his gambling buddy.
Yeah, no, Jordan was mad. I mean, he was so mad. And, you know, he took it out on Cartwright. I mean, he called a medical bill, you know, because he was always had sore knees. And you know, he would throw bad passes to him just so he wouldn't be able to get him. I mean, this, a lot of stuff is in that great Sam Smith book about the team. But, you know, he was really awful to Bill. But Bill pushed back, and Bill stood up to him, you know. And the problem really inside that team was that, you know, all this stuff about the triangle offense, you know, this was Michael Jordan's team, and you had to play Michael Ball, you know, and all the other players on the team were so scared of him and so, you know, personally hurt by things he'd said that they just didn't want to play for the guy, you mm-hmm. know. And it was Cartwright who came in, and Cartwright was this guy to a T, an exact personality. I mean, he expected nothing and wanted no attention, and he mentored the younger players. He got everyone to buy into playing this kind of basketball, and you know, that was really was that selfless work that he did. You know, playing through great pain. You know, not scoring, even though he could have scored. You know, he'd scored a lot in his career. You know, just really doing whatever needed to be done, and you know, that's what helped them. That's what turned them into a three-time winner. And then, you know, after he left, they had Steve Kerr, you know, who came in and did the same job of pushing back against Jordan. In fact, Jordan punched him in the face at a practice once, famously. They got a fight. And Pippen, you know, contributed, I think, to that as well. So, you know, that formula is kind of what drove them to the titles. And you know, again, it's hard to swallow because, especially in basketball, where you know, a star, they're only five players, right? And you think the star has a huge impact. But, you know, if you go back and look at the best players in the history of the NBA and then the people who've won the most titles, I mean, there's just, you know, there's a lot of gaps in that chart. I mean,
it's really interesting. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, I could go on for days, and I know as all the sports people on the that are listening that could as well. I think one of the things that really kind of, you know, if you go back and you look now at, you know, a Steve Kerr now, and now he's leading his own team and one of the best teams ever, certainly currently. How would you suggest our listeners or a leader today think about, you know, you mentioned at the beginning that coach wasn't quite as important as you might have thought they were. And if you think of kind of the current hierarchical structure of an organization, you know, many of our listeners lead a team. So how should they be thinking about developing those people on their team? You know, you're not going to have a traditional captain necessarily underneath a leader in an organization, but should they?
Yeah, no, well, this is really, you know, an interesting thing because, yeah, you're right. Corporate structures do not lend themselves perfectly to this kind of arrangement, right? It's much more crisp and clear on a sports team. But, you know, when you look inside an organization, like, this is really about the whole thing. It's about the whole thing from top to bottom, you know, because there's so many different levels of the company. And, you know, inside a company, it's funny because, you know, you may be a coach and a captain at the same time. You're a coach or you're a coach and a player at the same time. And everyone kind of has someone above them who is managing, you know, all the way up to the top. And I think the important thing here is, I think the really big, two big takeaways for business. And the first one is, you know, there is one direct report that you have, most of us, who, you know, is someone who, you know, is really that person that you rely on to do things, to get things done, right? And, you know, to marshal the resources to get things done. And you may have several of those people, you know, you may just have one, but those relationships and those relationships are so important. And that's the thing that about coaches that I did not understand. And that really surprised me. They're not, it's not that they're not important. In fact, they're more important. You know, but in a way that I didn't understand. I mean, I thought coaches said culture and lead, you know, and inspire, but that's not it. What a coach needs to do is have a partnership with that captain. And that's what I saw all of the great coaches, you know, the coaches that we know on the list, like, you know, Bill Belichick and Greg Popovich and, you know, even Phil Jackson or Alex Ferguson, the Manchester United. I mean, they all had this incredible bond with their captain. And, you know, it was funny because it wasn't always a peaceful thing. I mean, Brady and Belichick will fight and disagree with each other. And sometimes they'll, one will get their way and sometimes the other. But, they, you know, Brady takes criticism from him all the time, from Belichick. And, you know, Duncan and Popovich would fight so much that, you know, Duncan would sometimes sit at the scorer's table because he didn't want to be anywhere near Pop. But, you know, they loved each other, but they knew how to fight. And they would fight. They would get into a lot of conflict. And there was a lot of push and pull. But it was more of a partnership than a hierarchical thing, you know, and that was so important. And I think it's hard for a lot of managers, you know, like a lot of coaches to do what Steve Kerr does, which is to lower himself in relation to the team. You know, Steve Kerr, you know, has a leadership group on the Warriors, which has Andre Iguodala, who's a classic captain in the mold that I've described. And he also has Draymond Green and Steph Curry who contribute to the leadership. And, you know, he is so democratic with them. I mean, there was a game last season I wrote about where he let them coach.
He let them coach the team. Yeah.
See, you guys coach the team. And he literally did nothing, just sat on the bench. I've never seen that before. And that takes a level of humility that I think is kind of trained or beaten out of us when we take management jobs. But that's really, it's so intensely collaborative. And I think, you know, if you look at your team that way and you think, you know, the only way this team's going to work is if me as the leader, the coach, the manager, you know, takes a really intense collaborative approach with the most important, most effective people, the best leaders, you know, who are kind of running things on the ground. And, you know, that's in every part of an organization. I mean, from the top down. And I think if you can have those relationships and that structure going all the way through your organization, then I think, you know, great things can happen.
Well, it's a great visual too, right? I mean, it's just so true. And I think there's this thing that, you know, there's so many micromanagers out there, Sam, and, you know, they feel like they have to do everything because it's the only way that we can ensure it gets done. And in reality, it's the giving away of those things. It's the developing of other human beings, the other partners in the team that when, you know, maximum capacity can actually be realized. But it's a very difficult thing for people to kind of come to grips with because they got in the position because they were really good at the job. And yeah. It's a fascinating journey, if you will. We believe leadership is a journey and not a destination. And so it's just a great visual. You get to leave our audience with one bit of advice today, Sam. What would it be?
Oh man, you know, it's tough to think of one thing, but I think the most important thing is if you want to be a great leader, it is a weird, weird sensation. I mean, you're not going to get the credit. You shouldn't get the credit. You know, you have to be able to, in private moments, say, I did that. You know, I did that. Even though no one, you know, is going to, no one's pointing at you. You're not getting any awards or plaques, you know, but you know, at the end of the day, that your effort and your hard work created the success that everyone else is enjoying. And other people may enjoy it way more than you and get way more out of it than you will in terms of money and prestige and fame and accolades. But you have to just have that satisfaction that you made this possible. You know, and it's a very lonely sort of comfort, but that's what it takes, you know. And if you can get yourself to that point where you really are genuinely happy for other people, even if they're getting the credit for something that you made possible, then you're ready. You're ready to do anything. And we need more people like that.
That's an inspiring message for someone that doesn't think speeches are that great. That got me fired up. So thank you. Where can people get the book, find out more about your work? Where's the best place to send people?
Well, the book's still out and everywhere and online and Amazon and everything. And I have a website called bysamwalker.com, which has a little bit more on it. I need to update it a little. And I'm on Twitter, Sam Walkers. And I'm not the greatest at keeping up, but I do what I can. And I do a lot of speaking and do some appearances and various things. So, I think I'm pretty easy to find.
Well, we can't thank you enough for your work. Thanks for making the time to come on the show.
Thanks, John. Great pleasure.